Hey, Kenny, I am so excited that we are here tonight together recording. And I think I'm just as excited for the audience to listen all the way through to hear about Jimena's amazing movie pick.
Hey, Carolyn, I completely agree. I can't believe I haven't seen this yet, but it is definitely on my list. And turns out it's like within this subgenre of films that is right up my alley.
And I think what's even better is, you know, Curbsiders, we like to keep you on your toes. So we actually put the pick of the week at the very end of the show. Welcome back to the Curbsiders Addiction Medicine, our mini series on substance use disorders. I'm Dr. Carolyn Chan, joined by my co-host, Dr. Kenny Morford. On tonight's episode, we'll discuss sedative hypnotic use disorders with Dr. Jimena Lavander. Before we get started with that, Kenny, will you please tell the audience, what the heck do we do on this show?
Sure, Carolyn. We are the internal medicine podcast for all things addiction medicine. We use expert interviews to bring you teaching pearls and practice-changing knowledge to inspire the next generation of medical educators. And a reminder that most episodes are available for free CME credit through VCU Health CE for all health professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. All you have to do is create an account.
And as always, a very special thanks to the American College of Academic Addiction Medicine, also known as ACAM, who have partnered with us to help support the Curbsiders Addiction Medicine miniseries. ACAM is the proud home for academic addiction medicine faculty and trainees, and they are committed to supporting and training the next generation of academic addiction medicine leaders. Learn more about the organization at their website, acam.org.
The Curbsiders Addiction Medicine is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only. The topics discussed should not be used to diagnose, treat, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the hosts and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity aside from possibly Cashlack Memorial Hospital. In short, we aren't responsible if you screw up. Please do your homework and let us know if we got something wrong. We have a fantastic conversation with our guest, Dr. Jimena Lavander, who is an assistant professor of medicine and clinician investigator at Oregon Health and Science University in the Division of General Internal Medicine and Geriatrics and in the section of addiction medicine. So in her clinical practice, Dr. Lavander splits her time working at the OHSU Outpatient Addiction and Complex Pain Clinic. She also works in their inpatient addiction medicine consult service, as well as at the OHSU Harm Reduction Low Barrier Buprenorphine Bridge Clinic.
It's really a great episode. She teaches us a ton. So I think I really enjoyed her discussion on how to actually approach patients who are using non-prescribed benzodiazepines and really like how to probe with them to help decide, you know, is this medication that they're taking, is it really a prescription benzodiazepine? Could it be counterfeit? Are they getting it from some other location? And she follows that up by honestly giving us like very practical tips on how to manage benzodiazepine withdrawal. We talk about controversies surrounding CEWA. And then finally, she walks us through how do we actually develop and create a patient-centered care plan for a benzodiazepine taper. I think we're ready to get into our first case. Hey, Jimena, thanks for coming on the show. We're really excited to have you here. So if it's okay with you, we would like to start with just a couple of questions to get to know you a little bit better. So can you please tell us a one-liner to describe yourself?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on here today. I'm really excited to be part of this podcast episode. So a little bit about me. I am an assistant professor at Oregon Health and Science University in Portland, Oregon, and I am in the Division of General Internal Medicine and Geriatrics in the section of addiction medicine. And my clinical work is split into three different areas of expertise where I work on the inpatient addiction consult service. And I also work at our addiction and complex pain clinic, which is an outpatient clinic. And then I also work at our low barrier buprenorphine clinic as well. And my main area is that I work in clinical research. So about 75% of my time is spent in research, and my area of interest is in telemedicine for substance use disorder treatment.
That is an impressive number of hats.
I wear a lot of hats, and I have to switch between the hats many times per day.
Yeah, it's also an impressive number of different clinical sites that you work in. And, you know, so along those lines, can you tell us some of your favorite aspects of working in the field of addiction medicine?
Sure. So thanks for highlighting the differences in my clinical settings. That's done by design. I'm really interested in care transitions and how to improve care transitions between inpatient and outpatient and low barrier settings. And that's one of the things I love about addiction is getting to work with patients in lots of different spaces and being able to meet patients where they are at and where they want to receive their care. I also I think for me, addiction medicine overlays a lot of the things that I find joy in terms of like justice and in advocacy. And so being able to improve care both in a clinical encounter as well as outside by doing advocacy work as well.
Well, I'm happy that we have you working on that because care transitions are hard in any field of medicine, but I know that we have some specific challenges when we're caring for people with substance use disorders. So speaking of care transitions, maybe we should get started with our case that involves a patient who is coming to you after leaving the hospital. So we have Mr. Webb. He is a 34-year-old man, and he's presenting to your clinic for hospital follow-up after experiencing a seizure from benzodiazepine withdrawal. And he says for the past year, he's been taking about 4 milligrams of what he thinks is alprazolam per day from a friend where he buys it from. And he also says that more recently, he started buying benzodiazepines from the dark web. So, you know, it sounds like this person is using both non-prescribed alprazolam as well as maybe some other benzodiazepines that he's getting on the internet. Can you briefly describe some common types of benzodiazepines and also some of these novel benzodiazepines that he's obtaining from the internet?
Sure. So when I see a patient who is first coming to see me and talking around using benzodiazepines, I always want to know more about where they're getting their benzodiazepines and are they getting them prescribed from a clinician, whether it's primary care or specialty like a psychiatrist or an addiction medicine provider. Or are they getting them non-prescribed? And when they're getting them non-prescribed, there's sort of two categories that I'm interested in. Are they getting them through someone else's prescription? And so they know someone who has a prescription for alprazolam and they're taking them, whether known or unknown, from that person. Are they getting non-prescribed benzodiazepines via like pressed pills, so they don't actually know whether it's a prescription, but they're what look like a prescription. So there's been a lot of counterfeit pressed pills that I've been seeing and that have been coming up where the person thinks that they're getting alprazolam, but then when you actually test for the bar, it actually doesn't have alprazolam in it or contains other substances as well. So there's non-prescribed, definitely know it's a prescription or may not be that prescription, but they think it is. And then there are benzodiazepines that people are now purchasing through the internet or dark web. And those come in lots of different flavors. And when you're purchasing something off the internet, very rarely do you know what it is. And the first time this came up for me was actually when I was a fellow and a patient came in to see me for detox. And they said that they were using clonazolam. And I was like, clonazolam? And I typed that into UpToDate, which is what most people do when they don't know what the person is talking about. And when I typed in clonazolam, it said, did you mean clonazepam? So even UpToDate didn't have any up-to-date information about this novel psychoactive substance or non-prescribed benzodiazepine that this person had purchased. And so I actually then put it into my search engine and was able to find more information about it via Reddit forums. And so I actually was like turning to patients of the community to find out more information about one of these substances. So there's lots of different types of benzodiazepines that have gotten into the US market. And actually the European market is a good signal for what we can anticipate seeing because the European drug supply in terms of benzodiazepines seems to be a few years ahead of us.
And this is what I think is so challenging about caring and managing and developing a treatment plan for folks with sedative hypnotic disorders, because so often we don't know exactly what they're taking, right? Exactly because of all the reasons you said. We're just seeing a ton of counterfeit pills. And like often in my practice, I will ask patients like, hey, can we do a urine drug screen? Just because it's helpful to actually see if what you're taking is actually what you think you're taking, right? Just even for safety purposes. But, you know, I think also interpreting urine drug screens with benzodiazepines, it can be a little tricky sometimes. So are there any sort of like caveats or common errors you see folks make when they're interpreting urine drug screens for benzodiazepines?
Yes, that's a great question. So with these novel psychoactive substances, these benzodiazepines, they most frequently do not show up on urine drug screens. So I think the first thing that I would alert people to who are concerned that a patient may be using one of these is that a negative urine drug test for benzodiazepines does not mean that a person is not using benzodiazepines. And so if that's something that someone is concerned about, wanting to send it out for confirmatory gas chromatography testing. So you have to, and you have to actually specify like which substances you're interested in, and often send it to a specialty lab that can run these tests. So I think that that's one piece. And then I think the other piece when I think about interpreting urine drug screens is that anytime I see something that I'm not expecting, that I never make a clinical decision based off of a screen. I always send things off for confirmation. And then using it as a way to like open up a conversation with the patient. So if I see an unexpected benzodiazepine result show up, I'll ask the patient, what do you think about that test result? What do you think that means? And if that can sort of be a point of opening up a conversation and not changing any treatment plan, stopping any other medication simply because of one test that comes back.
Totally. I feel like I see the same in my practice too. Honestly, not only just benzodiazepines that are sort of novel or from places outside the US, but even ones within the US, right? I think clonazepam is a medication that if someone has been on a low dose stably, that's not something I'm necessarily going to see on an immunoassay, because it really depends what the immunoassay was designed to detect, because there are so many different types of benzos. Doesn't necessarily mean the patient isn't taking it, right? So in my practice too, I do a ton of send outs for confirmations if it's clinically appropriate and needed. But I agree that like benzodiazepines are just a little bit more challenging, I think, to interpret their urine drug screen results of from.
But it's important to understand like how the benzodiazepine is metabolized and exactly like is the immunoassay detecting for that metabolite. And a lot of them don't test for the metabolites for clonazepam. So you do need to send that out if you're wanting confirmation that the person is taking a medication that you're prescribing.
So we've talked about these kind of the benzodiazepines that we've heard about, clonazepam, you know, alprazolam, I think diazepam we can throw in there as well as these other ones that, you know, like are news to me, like clonazolam. But are, you know, while we're just talking about the broader class of sedative hypnotics, are there just certain other medications that are similar to these benzodiazepines that we should have on our radar?
So I ask patients about medications that they're taking that may also interfere with buprenorphine or with opioids. I always ask about gabapentinoids. Not that I think gabapentin or pregabalin will cause someone to overdose when taken alone, but it's more that we've seen some reports of gabapentin or pregabalin being in people's systems at overdoses, that they may be a contributing medication. And there have been some reports of increasing misuse of these medications. Other medications I think of that are sedatives include Zolpidem, and then I also think about the class of barbiturates, which you don't see very frequently anymore. And then I also will sometimes ask patients about muscle relaxants that may also be sedating, though they have a different mechanism of action.
Totally. So what would you say, you know, for our patients coming to us, often they're saying, you know, I'm using, you know, a benzo because it helps me. So what are some clinical indications for benzodiazepines?
Yeah, so the main clinical indications for benzodiazepines are for treatment of anxiety, generalized anxiety disorder, for panic disorders, agoraphobia, and also for insomnia. But they're really indicated for short-term indications and are not regularly recommended for long-term use for management of these clinical indications. Also use benzodiazepines very frequently when I'm treating alcohol withdrawal. We use CWA protocol and administer benzodiazepines, since benzodiazepines are the treatment for one of the mainstays of treatment for management of alcohol withdrawal.
So you mentioned that, you know, we typically should do a short course of benzodiazepines in terms of what the clinical indications are that you had listed. You know, just even with a short course, are there certain adverse effects that we should be aware of?
Yeah, so even with short courses of benzodiazepines, people can develop a physiologic dependence in as little as 2 weeks. So definitely when starting a patient on a medication, on a benzodiazepine for a short term, I would caution them about the possibility of developing a physiologic dependence on the benzodiazepine in a relatively short period of time. And benzodiazepines are listed for the on the beer's list of medications. So, you know, be worried about falls, confusion, over sedation, memory, lost memory issues. A lot of patients who've been using benzodiazepines for a long time, that's things that you worry about. Mostly worry about medication interactions and people get put on a new medication, changes in metabolism that happen as someone ages that can then result in someone who's on a stable dose now really being a higher effective dose that can result in falls and sedation and that can result in injury.
Got it. So, you know, thinking back to our case, so our patient tells us that he started taking alprazolam for anxiety, but now he's really just worried about having another seizure. So you'd mentioned these adverse effects of, you know, both short-term and long-term benzodiazepine use. Can you give us a little more detail about what the symptoms are for benzodiazepine withdrawal?
Yeah, so some of the symptoms that I see in patients who are having, who are trying to withdraw off of benzodiazepines, they can certainly get a seizure if they're stopped abruptly or if the dose reduction is too high. Some of the withdrawal symptoms I mentioned a little bit earlier, but I think of people having rebound symptoms of what they originally were treating, which mostly ends up being anxiety, panic symptoms, and then other withdrawal symptoms can be a lot of like irritability and poor mood. People can get GI symptoms as well, because your GI symptoms, like your whole GI system are innervated. And so if you're suddenly removing the benzodiazepines, you can get GI symptoms. And then, you know, inability to, you know, difficulty sleep, insomnia, I mean, the main symptoms that I hear. And then like people can also have, you know, brain fog, brain confusion, difficulty concentrating. And these, it's difficult to describe. I almost think of them as like what we use to, like, the symptoms that people have that you then treat with gabapentin, sort of like that neuropathic kind of like nerve being turned back on. And they're sort of described as these like zaps. And they also can happen with people who suddenly stop like venlafaxine.
As you highlighted, this is a whole list of miserable, miserable symptoms. Like it is super, it's super miserable to go through, you know, benzodiazepine withdrawal. And it's something I think we don't talk about enough. And this is why I think it's really important that we should be aware and think about assessing and diagnosing them appropriately. Do you think about using any validated scores, particularly like in the hospital setting, to monitor somebody for benzodiazepine withdrawal?
There's not a lot of literature evidence around benzodiazepine withdrawal or management of benzodiazepine withdrawal. So a lot of it is taken from the alcohol withdrawal literature, and then you try to apply that because you're working with similar receptors, but they do have a different feel, I think, to patients. I think that the benzodiazepine withdrawal period can be a little bit more protracted than alcohol, and people can have symptoms for a much longer period of time after stopping benzodiazepines than with alcohol. But in the hospital, like in a withdrawal management program or detox program, CIWA is often used, particularly when we're talking about this patient where we don't really know how much benzodiazepine they're using. So putting them on a scheduled taper may end up giving them too much. You could try and come up with some amount, but you'll likely end up needing to add some additional as needed benzodiazepine in addition. And that's where the CIWA is something that we've used.
Yeah. And I do something similar in my practice where I'll use the CIWA because it's kind of like the best thing we have for right now.
We use the same protocol that we use for alcohol to determine when to administer benzodiazepines for benzodiazepine withdrawal. I will say, I think that they're, benzodiazepines, I think, can be a little bit more deceptive, where you can have people who don't score as high and then all of a sudden have seizures, as opposed to alcohol, where I think there seems to be a little bit more correlation with numbers being increasing and then increasing likelihood of seizure. I don't know if that's something that you all have seen or heard as well.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard that as well. And I think, you know, when I've worked on our inpatient addiction medicine consult service, we will have people monitored on the CYAR, so the alcohol, like CYA
if they're coming in with benzodiazepine withdrawal, which I think is, you know, I mean, it's not entirely evidence-based. Like the CYAR was not meant for benzodiazepine withdrawal, and there is a CYB. But from my understanding, the CYB was, you know, it's an instrument that's really used for research purposes, and it wasn't as closely linked to like a symptom triggered protocol for how to give benzodiazepines based on those scores. So that the, you know, next best thing we have is to just use the CYAR.
And in my practice, one thing that I'm doing pretty consistently, honestly, is like, I'm not exclusively doing symptom triggered for my folks who have sedative hypnotic use disorders and I'm training for benzo withdrawal. Like generally I'm trying to make a guess at what equivalency I have to give them some base. Cause I do agree. Cause I'm worried about the risk of the seizure. I sort of agree that like, if I don't give anybody anything, even at least a small dose of something to start their day, I worry that I'm putting that person at risk if I wait till their CY, you know, hits 8. So I usually do give them a base and then add symptom triggered PRNs on top of that.
So, you know, along those lines, I'm interested, Jimena, you know, like this idea of converting to different benzodiazepine equivalents, like how do you go about that? I think a lot of people are trained how to do opioid equivalencies, but benzos can be, you know, we know it exists, but is that something that you feel like you rely on a lot?
Yeah, so I tend to transition people to a longer acting benzodiazepine. I find that patients are better able to tolerate doing a taper on diazepam or clonazepam as opposed to alprazolam or even sometimes lorazepam. It just, the half-life is longer. You're able to titrate it down in a more like regimented and slow fashion. I use the Ashton manual pretty regularly to come up with taper schedules and use that for equivalencies. But part of it too is that I think the equivalent, even the opioid equivalents aren't perfect, but I think the opioid equivalent charts are better than the benzodiazepine equivalent charts because there's usually a pretty wide range. I think people's metabolism of benzodiazepines varies a lot more. And so I think there can be some difficulties when doing those conversions and just being mindful that if you do a conversion from alprazolam to diazepam and you think that you did it right and the patient's like, this isn't working, it may just be that you underdose them and you just need to adjust up a little bit.
I'm curious, do you have any favorite resources? They're so many available.
Yeah, you know, so the one that I use the most is called Global RPH. It's just like you can, it's a website. It has a bunch of different dose equivalencies, but you can type in benzodiazepines into that calculator and it pulls up a list of a bunch of different types of benzodiazepines. And then you can say what you want to convert it to and it'll pop out a milligram dosage. But, you know, like Jimena said, I think that when I've had to do this, I often have to adjust it a bit once I see the response from the patient because there's variability and, you know, I kind of always take it with a grain of salt.
Yeah. So just to sort of summarize, if an individual is using a short acting benzodiazepine, you often like to convert it to a long acting benzo. And to do that, there are equivalency calculators, references out there that help give you like a solid starting point. But it's important to remember to be flexible and really make adjustments based on the patient's symptoms.
I think the other thing I'll say is that if a person does have hepatic dysfunction, to be really, really careful because a lot of the longer acting benzodiazepines do have a lot of active metabolites. And so I probably wouldn't use diazepam in somebody who had severe hepatic impairment. And I've been trying to get oxcarbazepine on our formulary at OHSU for a while and haven't been successful, but that is what's used in a lot of the like withdrawal management programs for patients who are concerned about having more hepatic dysfunction as opposed to lorazepam because it has less hepatic issues.
So without that medication on your formulary, do you have a go-to benzodiazepine for patients with severe underlying liver disease?
We use lorazepam, but there's still some concern around hepatic impairment with that. I'm curious what you all use.
We do the same.
I guess I just would not use chlordiazepoxide in patients who have hepatic impairment because that one I've seen give scheduled chlordiazepoxide and then 2 days later, the patient is very, very, very sedated.
So be cautious, listeners, be cautious. And I think too, like, so now we've talked so much about sort of like how you think about starting either a medically supervised detox. I think whenever these patients come into the hospital, right, I'm always like, is this going to be a medically supervised detox? Is this going to be like a prolonged taper? Do I ever think about using benzodiazepines as maintenance therapy? So I'm curious, like, one, could you sort of discuss and take us through those different options for patients and tell us your thoughts?
Yeah. So I think when thinking about whether or not someone needs to come off of benzodiazepines, whether or not they're being prescribed or they're taking them non-prescribed, I think you have to think about what are the potential harms to the patient at the time, like sort of going through your risk-benefit calculation with any medication. And so if a patient is prescribed a benzodiazepine, they're taking it and they're doing well, and they're not really having any adverse consequences related to that, and you're not concerned about a benzodiazepine use disorder, I think similar to the conversations that we're having around continued opioid prescribing, I think continuing someone on a benzodiazepine, even though it wouldn't be your preferred medication, it's not what you would likely start if you saw them for the first time in clinic, I would likely continue that benzodiazepine if that's what the patient wants. Now, a lot of patients are, now that they're seeing more and more information around concerns around benzodiazepines, people are starting to come maybe wanting to discontinue or reduce their dose of the benzodiazepine. And so I think whether or not you need to do it quickly or over a long period of time really depends on the types of adverse consequences the patient is facing and the difficulty that they're having with doing a taper. So if they're someone who, it, you know, has stable housing, has other people who, you know, they live with, who can care for them, who they have reliably like come to clinic and have a phone, then they might be someone who are more open to doing a more prolonged taper, and they're not having like active harms associated with their ongoing benzodiazepine use. But if there's somebody who has recently overdosed on prescribed or non-prescribed benzodiazepines, if there's someone who is actively using other substances, if they're not stably housed, they don't have a safe place to store medications, that's someone who I would do a more rapid taper on, though the success rate on rapid tapers is not very high. But the success rate on prolonged tapers is also not very high. Like, I think at least a third of patients within a year will be back using benzodiazepines. So I think we have to also be realistic that that benzodiazepines are really hard to stop. And there's a lot of similar to very like high rates of opioid prescribing that happened. There's was high rates of benzodiazepine prescribing, and there's a lot of iatrogenic harms that have come from that. And so we need to be willing to help walk patients through those harms that have been happened to them by the healthcare system. And it may take multiple iterations of helping them stop this medication that's been harmful for them.
You bring up a really good point about just like kind of this iatrogenic benzodiazepine dependence. And, you know, I've noticed that in some of my patients, they'll come in similar to this case that we discussed, where they had an adverse event, like a withdrawal seizure, and then come to see me. And, you know, when I get more history, I learn that they didn't even realize that seizures were an adverse consequence of, you know, of taking even prescribed benzodiazepines. Have you noticed that in your practice as well, that patients just don't really go through that whole like informed consent process?
Yeah. So I think, you know, patients were started on benzodiazepines in 70s and 80s and 90s, and we're seeing them now and we're like, you're 70 years old. Why are you still on this medication? It'd be really nice if you weren't on it. And they never went through an informed consent process. And I think part of that was how counseling was done in that time period. But then also, you know, benzodiazepines were designed as a replacement for barbiturates and were sort of sold as the safer alternative to barbiturates. And so I think physicians weren't really as aware or as open with patients around the potential harms that the benzodiazepines would have. And so there actually is a great article that a couple colleagues at OHSU have out in JAMA Psychiatry that sort of describes this new clinical condition that we may want to consider using called complex persistent benzodiazepine dependence. So again, similar thinking of like a correlate with opioids, a sort of complex opioid dependence. Patients who are on opioids prescribed, benzodiazepines prescribed, and when they try and discontinue them, they have difficulty coming off of these medications, and they were started by clinicians, and they don't want to be on them anymore. Or maybe they do, and they're not causing them harms, but our healthcare system is suddenly saying, wait a second, you shouldn't be on these medications, and thinking about who are we treating when we're trying to taper people off of opioids and benzodiazepines? Are we trying to make ourselves feel better? Are we trying to make the clinic feel better, the insurance companies feel better, or are we trying to make the patient feel better? And I think if we recenter the conversation around what does the patient need and what does the patient want, I think we can often come up with the correct answer.
So Hemeta, can you tell us kind of a little more detail about your approach and how you might do a rapid versus prolonged taper for benzodiazepines?
Sure. So I think a rapid taper, if someone's needing a rapid taper, probably means that they need to be in an inpatient setting because they need to come off the medication relatively quickly, and it's just going to be really difficult for them to be able to tolerate that rapid of a taper outpatient. So in a hospital setting, you can monitor them and give them as needed medications, and you're usually looking at 3 days to a week, usually, that you can get approval to get the person in the hospital or inpatient setting for. And that's where we use the CWA score that we're talking about earlier to administer additional medications and usually add an adjunctive medication. In the hospital, we're using gabapentin, sometimes carbamazepine, it's another medication, or valproic acid, depending on someone who can get pregnant or might be pregnant, then obviously wouldn't use valproic acid, but it can work really well to try and help with some of those more prolonged symptoms that can happen. And then in the outpatient setting, if someone's coming to me and wants to taper off their benzodiazepines, it really depends on how long they've been on the benzodiazepines for. Most people I'm seeing have been on benzodiazepines for years. So if someone's been on a medication for years, it's going to take them a while to come off of the medication. And that's the first thing that I tell them. So we have to come up with a plan to do something over several weeks to months. And I calculate how much they're using, convert to a long acting. Even sometimes the transition from short acting to long acting, you may want to do over 2 to 3 weeks, because we were talking about those dose equivalents aren't always exactly what you think they're going to be. And so because you're dosing the benzodiazepine 2 to 3 times per day, you can switch out the morning, keep the morning one as the short acting and transition the evening dose to the long acting. And then over a couple weeks, start to make that transition to it all being long acting and then start to dose reduce. I'm usually reducing by no more than 10-ish% per week. And then I warn patients that the last few weeks are usually the most challenging, because when you think about it, when you're going from 10 milligrams to 8 milligrams of diazepam, that's 20% reduction. But when you're going from 3 milligrams to 2 milligrams, that's a 33% reduction, and you really can't go much slower than that. So that's what I think of when I think of a long taper. You're really planning for more weeks to months. And I'm usually seeing patients on a weekly basis, unless I'm really convinced that they're going to be doing well.
Got it. So just to kind of summarize all this about the two approaches for rapid tapers versus prolonged tapers, it sounds like for rapid tapers, pretty much always doing that in an inpatient setting. Maybe it's, you know, over like 5 to 7 days. It's for a patient who has had an adverse consequence and it's a safety issue to get them off of the benzodiazepine as soon as possible. You might add on some adjunctive medications like gabapentin, valproic acid, carbamazepine to help. And you said with prolonged symptoms, so maybe those medications might be continued on after the taper is complete.
Yes, exactly. Something I would discharge the patient with as an additional medication to use. Correct.
And then for these prolonged tapers, we're thinking like weeks to months. We want to first start by really transitioning them from a short-acting benzodiazepine to a long-acting one. Might do that as a cross-taper or kind of a two-week stabilization period on that equivalent dose, and then start to slowly go down by like a, you know, 10% per week is what you had mentioned, and giving them that warning that the last few weeks is really going to be, you know, could be more challenging because you have to go down by much smaller doses.
Right. And then I usually try and take advantage of twice a day or three times a day dosing with the long taper schedule. And what's nice about three times a day dosing is that the middle of the day dose, people will sometimes start to forget on their own. And so that can be a nice way to kind of sort of auto taper in the beginning part, making the beginning part of the taper easier to try and get, you know, additional buy-in from patients. And then checking in at key periods of the taper that I know are going to be more challenging. So if it's someone who, you know, you're a busy primary care clinic, you may not be able to see people every week, seeing them every, you know, 2 to 3 weeks, but really making sure you check in on those key periods where you know things are going to be more challenging. So if you are doing that cross taper, but, you know, right before you start to go to only the single agent, then when you're going from three times a day to twice a day, and then when you're going from twice a day to once per day, like really checking in with people during those periods of time. And then I will add that I also offer the adjunctive medications outpatient as well. Again, there isn't a ton of evidence on these adjunctive medications. I would love an RCT looking at head-to-head comparisons of them, but they just aren't available. So thinking about sort of mechanism of action of what I use for alcohol withdrawal, using gabapentin, carbamazepine, or valproic acid are usually my go-tos, with obviously checking levels if I'm using valproic acid.
Jimena, we're just waiting for you to do that study to answer all of our burning benzodiazepine questions.
I'll add it to my long list of ideas. And then I also offer, so if a patient started using the benzodiazepine for treatment of anxiety, I do recommend evidence-based treatments for anxiety disorders. So I'll offer SSRIs, medications like buspirone can also be helpful. And I try and start those before we start doing the withdrawal period, though I tend to define in my clinical practice that most patients, if they want to stop the benzodiazepines, don't want to start an SSRI. That's just been my own clinical experience. That may not be the case for everybody, so I do always offer. And then if people have been using the benzodiazepines for insomnia, I do offer CBTI. So cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, which has tons of evidence that it's very helpful for managing insomnia symptoms.
I think that you made a great point. So we can't forget that our patient has underlying generalized anxiety disorder. So it makes a lot of sense to offer a first-line evidence-based treatment for that individual and to be flexible, you know, with that person. I also thought that was like a great suggestion of like offering CBTI. Are there any other psychosocial interventions that you would recommend for our patient? And, you know, I should have stated this explicitly, but let's say our patient, he definitely meets criteria for sedative hypnotic disorder. So he meets severe criteria based on the DSM-5.
Yeah. So I think that is important to, you know, distinguish between, you know, does a person meet criteria for a set of hypnotic use disorder versus, you know, it's sort of more of this like complex persistent benzodiazepine dependence or wants to stop using their benzodiazepine for other reasons. So if other treatments for anxiety disorders, as you know, we can refer to mental health or to therapy, thinking about CBT as well. I think it's been really difficult it's already been really difficult to get into mental health treatment. And so I think being mindful of, if you recommend that for a patient, that it can be difficult to get in that referral.
I'll say in my own practice too, I know at the end of the taper, sometimes it becomes a little bit longer because I do think that the end of the taper tends to be more challenging. So what may have been a taper every week may turn into, you know, 2 or 3 weeks, depending on sort of the person and the scenario.
Sometimes at the end of a taper, I'm trying to get the person to go from, you know, 1 milligram or 2 milligrams of diazepam every evening, and they just can't seem to completely stop. And so I'll say, can you alternate? Can you use it every other night or more as needed when you feel like you're not able to, and then try and completely stop it. But I do, those last 3 to 4 weeks are particularly challenging. And then other sort of non-medication treatments, if a person comes in and I see that they have a smartphone, whether it's an iPhone or Android type device, I will talk to them about apps that are available that they can sometimes use. The VA has a ton of free apps that they've developed for management of anxiety symptoms and insomnia. I personally recommend I like the Breathe to Relax app. So it's breathe, the number two, relax. And that one goes through like box breathing with patients who breathing can be helpful for management of anxiety symptoms. But I do know they have a whole slew of various different free apps that people can use.
Yeah, I love the Breathe to Relax app. I often use that for both myself and my patients. You know, you had talked about how both of you have had to prolong tapers, especially at the end sometimes, and, you know, maybe hold on to a dose a little bit longer because it's challenging for the patient to further decrease their benzodiazepine dose. And I'll say in my own practice, sometimes I can't get it down all the way. You know, I feel like I've gotten to a place of, you know, clonazepam 0.5 BID and I feel a bit stuck there. And Jimena, you had mentioned earlier that sometimes, especially in the case of complex persistent benzodiazepine dependence, that, you know, we feel it's the provider that feels like we have to stop the benzodiazepine. And, you know, maybe are there cases when it's safer to just continue it? When might you consider doing that, maintaining them on a low dose when it just seems like it is not feasible to, you know, to taper to discontinuation?
I mean, I think that gets back to the, you know, risk benefit discussion with the patient. And I think celebrating the win that the person was able to reduce their clonazepam use from maybe 2 milligrams twice a day to 3 times a day to 0.5 twice a day. That's a significant dose reduction, and the likelihood of harms is dose dependent. So if they're at that lower dose and they're feeling like that's effective for them and it's managing their symptoms and they're not having harms from it, I don't think it's wrong to continue that medication. I do think that then it needs to be something that's sort of added to the every visit, being like, I wanted to revisit. How are things going? What are your thoughts on this? You know, screening for harms related to that ongoing benzodiazepine prescribing. But I do think we need to turn inwards and figure out, like, where is our discomfort from that medication coming from? I do think it's also important to make sure that we're not also prescribing medications that may be making it difficult for the person to stop their benzodiazepines. So we actually had a discussion today in our clinic around prescribing medications for ADHD, stimulant medications. Are we prescribing stimulants and then prescribing benzodiazepines to, you know, because a person is having insomnia related to the stimulant, and then we're prescribing benzodiazepines to help manage those symptoms? I think we need to be cautious of, we shouldn't be prescribing another potentially harmful medication to manage the symptoms from a potentially harmful medication. And so that might be a signal, hey, maybe I need to adjust their ADHD medication because I'm having difficulty completing this taper that the patient also agrees that they want to stop. So maybe there's something else that needs to be adjusted.
That's a really important point. And, you know, it's related to this kind of making sure that we are screening for diagnosing underlying psychiatric conditions, you know, maybe referring to psychiatry when that's out of the scope of what we can do in primary care. And by treating that underlying condition, then the benzodiazepine maybe becomes less needed for our patient. And the other thing I wanted to add was, when you talked about the risk-benefit discussion, it reminded me of this paper by Ted Park and his colleagues at Boston Medical Center that came out, I believe it was last year in 2021, about, it was looking at patients who use benzodiazepines who also have opioid use disorder, and they're treated with buprenorphine and I believe methadone as well. And just how patients and clinicians have very different views on benzodiazepines. And the clinicians are really focused on the risks, and patients tend to focus more on the benefits. And we have to recognize where we're both coming from and see, you know, it can be harmful if we go kind of too much in the on our side or the patient side.
No, totally. It's, I think, that same pendulum, like, you know, we were giving opioids and benzodiazepines to everybody, and now we're like, wait, those could have been harmful, and now we're taking them away from everybody, but suddenly taking away something that was helping alleviate some symptom or helping patients, all of a sudden, even if they were also causing harms, suddenly taking those away is going to be harmful. That act is harmful.
I want to thank you so much for being here with us tonight, Jimena. I just wanted to sort of be conscious of time and sort of start to wrap up. Do you have any main take-home points for our listeners?
Yeah, so I think the the main take homes for first, thanks for having me. It's been lovely. I think the first take home is I think people need to be aware of how people are using non-prescribed benzodiazepines and providing counseling to their patients around the concerns around counterfeit pills that have been increasing, and also asking patients directly around whether or not they're purchasing any substances via the internet, or if they're getting them from someone who's purchasing them via the internet. And just being aware that these are substances that aren't going to show up on routine urine drug tests. I think the other piece is being aware of the iatrogenic harms that happen from benzodiazepine prescribing, similar to opioids, and that some patients may have been started on them with when there wasn't a full risk-benefit discussion around the potential benefits and harms to being on benzodiazepines. And so when counseling patients around trying to taper off, recognizing that the history of how benzodiazepines were often started, and then going slow and long with benzodiazepine tapers if that's safe for the patient to do, because it seems to be some benefit, some increased likelihood of success if you're able to go slower, but that's not always possible with the risk-benefit calculation, and to consider adjunctive medications if the patient is open to using them to try and help manage both the acute withdrawal symptoms as well as the more prolonged withdrawal that we can see with benzodiazepines.
Do you have anything you want to plug tonight?
Sure. I want to talk about something completely random. So I recently introduced my partner to the greatest movie of all time, Josie and the Pussycats. So if anybody is interested in watching Josie and the Pussycats and then talking to me about it, I will be open to it. And there is a YouTube video, if you search Josie and the Pussycats is the greatest movie of all time, where a film critic goes through why Josie and the Pussycats is the greatest movie of all
time.
That
is a CD that I owned, by the way. I literally, as a teenager, bought that the CD album to that music. I don't know where it is anymore.
It's a great soundtrack. And it's actually, I can go into a whole discussion around Josie and the Pussycats, but it's a whole genre of movies that after watching this YouTube clip made me appreciate the sheer joy of movies that feature teen girls or young adult women and them living their lives and enjoying themselves. And don't we need more joy in our life right now?
Yes, we definitely do. So, and on that note, I think we'll wrap up. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Jimena. And I know what I'm watching this weekend.
So this has been another episode of our Curbsiders miniseries, The Curbsiders Addiction Medicine. Get your show notes now at thecurbsiders.com.
We're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge. And to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts or contact us at curbsidersaddictionmed@gmail.com. A special thanks to Dr. Matt Watto and Dr. Paul Williams for their support in this project, as well as to ACAM, or the American College of Academic Addiction Medicine. Learn more about the organization at acam.org.
And a reminder, folks, that this and most of our episodes are available for free CME credit for all healthcare professionals at curbsiders.bcuhealth.org. All you have to do is make an account. Until next time, I've been Dr. Carolyn Chan.
And I'm Dr. Kenny Morford. Thank you for joining us today and letting us bring you some pearls on addiction medicine.